Welcome to the Africa Speaking Podcast. The podcast discusses critical issues about the African continent. It is brought to you by Twaweza Communications in Nairobi. My name is Kimani Njogu. Let's continue with our discussion on constitution making in Kenya. We really would like to appreciate the journey that we have taken to be where we are. And I want to take you back to, of course, after the Second World War and India becoming independent.
1947.
There is almost a sense in which the struggles in the colonies have really gained momentum.
Yes.
And the colonial governments start doing things that would ensure their continuity. In the case of Kenya, of course, we have the Mau Mau, the Mau Mau struggle.
Yeah.
Most people assume that Mau Mau starts in 1952, but I've always thought that it starts earlier in different forms.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying, Rodney, because links and continuities.
Yes.
You can't reach the Mau Mau without talking about Mekitilili, without talking about Thuku, Mary Najiro, because there is a trajectory of resistance, and it's all connected.
And the resistance was taking place across the country.
Yes.
So amongst the Taita, you have Wanjiwa Maadori.
Yes.
Yegiriama, you have Mekatilili wa Menza.
Yeah.
And you have all these, you have literally resistances across Dini ya Musambwa. You have all these across the country.
You have that. Even when does the Muhindimbingo thing happen on dislocation?
Yes, it was
also
Muhindimbingo.
Yeah,
absolutely. And therefore, it seems like these resistances now gain really immense momentum, and they actually start now gaining a national character. You know, after the Second World War, after people come back from the wars, and they are feeling like there is a sense of solidarity, and of course, the apex of it becomes Mau Mau.
Mau Mau, and then you also see in the '40s the growth of unions, you know, led trade unions. In fact, it's on record that Makan Singh was the first Kenyans to call for independence in the '40s, and so there is a fusion of, you know, the, what you might call the working class. You know, the peasants are there. There are people who are in towns, the unions that brought Mboya about. You know, and the Mau Mau, of course, was a radical departure from the constitution making process, because they basically said, no, this
struggle.
It's just armed struggle that will get these guys out. Getting concessions from them is not enough. As you're saying, after the Second World War, it was very, very, very clear, even to the British Empire, that they were no longer an empire. There was another empire that arose from the ashes of the Second World War. Because that's how we see America, with the Marshall Plan, you know, propping up the Japanese and the Germans and the British, and the whole issue of the Cold War beginning almost, you know, almost immediately because of the, you know, Soviet Union.
Yes.
Yeah, and the revolutions. I mean, China is 49, also after the Second World War. Cuba is, I think, 59.
Yeah, 59,
and then Vietnam starts, you know, a particular period. But I think you are right to say that the dying empires and the ones that were coming up, and the whole question of what you might call the multipolar world, those interests are like the British were retreating, but
they were also trying to find a way.
Yes.
Because if you look at the Sinaton plan and you look at what they were trying to do with regard to demarcation and privatization of land and excluding, you know,
the Mau Mau
and so on.
Yeah.
And even doing certain tokenistic political adjustments to their regime by allowing, for example, a few Africans to sit in the legislative assembly.
Yeah, actually, before Mathu and others were nominated to sit in the Legislative Assembly, it's the church that represented us. I remember before Mathu, there was either a bishop or what, called Bicha. Okay, who was responding to the native interests?
We do talk about the Beecher education reports. He was involved in education and education reforms.
Yes, must
be the same Beecher.
And I guess he might also have, been involved, and that's where the Alliance connection comes in, because Alliance came from the missionaries.
Yes, Alliance High School.
Yes, and this question you are getting into, of preparing for building an elite that will rule, then Alliance High School, that's where, all the our rulers.
Yeah, they came from
Alliance. They came from.
They came from Alliance.
These are all of them.
They came from Alliance, and therefore it's the cultivation of an elite that would ensure certain continuities.
Yeah.
And that, really schooled in the mannerisms of Britain, almost paying homage to Britain and the ideals of Britain, and so on.
Yeah.
Except where you have a few rebels.
You know,
there were a few rebels, and though some of those rebels were actually expelled from those schools, so they were cultivating certain continuities.
Mm.
And I recall also, actually, in the late 50s, even with regard to language, they started something called the New Primary Approach, where you would NPA, where certain schools were selected to just teach in English and you not speak any other language other than English.
Mm-hmm.
So again, building this continuity.
They build on that, and the whole issue of, getting like Moi in 1955 to represent Africans, and then 57 having the first elected members of the LegCo. It was, a continuous process, because decolonization had actually started, the rough edges of it.
But tell me something, because it seems like the as we get close to 1963, there were all these efforts to get the Kenyan elite to go to Britain to discuss the Kenyan constitution. What was actually going on at that time?
I think constitution making during the colonial period was about neo-colonialism.
Yeah.
It was consolidating all those strategies that you've talked about, where you obviously had people take over power. The British didn't want a disruption in the Kenyan economy that was settler, dominated. And so they agreed that yes, you're going to be independent, and they didn't disclose when it will happen. And so this Lancaster House constitutional talks was basically dealing with the drafts, and also the British, I think, keeping us hopeful, without basically saying when we are going to get it. And of course, now the members of parliament, through CAU,
the Kenya African Union,
asking for Kenyatta to be released, the project of Kenyatta's release becomes very, very, very critical, because when he is released, he becomes president of KANU. Kishuru steps down, So it's done well. The Maumau lose their land. You have what the Kikuyus obviously call the Home Guards. The Home Guards, just like Lenana and others, if you go back to 1911, it's what we call the comprador bourgeoisie these days.
Yeah.
People who were, Lenana was probably the beginning of it, because he's the one who helped the two pacts, and the land was stolen, people say legally, but no, that wasn't the case. But the British system of divide and rule actually is very, very well shown in that case called El Jogo. That was challenging the 1911 movement of settlers, because they were not supposed to do what they did. It's interesting, I think Professor James Cathy has written on issues of how international law was used to legitimate that theft. And the divisions that the British were very quick to see the conflicts are over the issue of Laibon and Sendell. You see, got Sendell, and then Lenana fighting it out.
The
British moved on one side, and you know the rest is history. So they through the issues of chiefs and whatnot during all that particular period. They had their successors.
Now, it's very interesting for me how the former district officers, the former district commissioners, children of chiefs, and so on and so forth, are the ones who actually, in the early 1960s, occupy, you know, political leadership.
Yeah, those.
It's almost like they were being, they were either prepared or choreographed into leadership.
If you take the two chiefs, the two famous chiefs in Kitui, where I come from, the Mwendwa family. Ngala Mwendwa studied at Alliance. Chale Mwendwa, Alliance also, and then I think the UK. Kitile Mwendwa, who became the CJ.
The CJ, yeah.
Okay. Mm. There's another chief called Kasina. Mm. Same thing about, you know, education. Oxford and some of those places. Then the other category was, of course, the missionary one. You know, the canons
and
so forth.
Yes.
Their kids also, you know, came in. And if you track, you see Anyang Nyong'o's father was a canon. Then the Awori and others. So it's through through education and through the chiefs, you know, and the administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, people like Michuki was what? Wasn't he officer?
No, he was a district officer in the colonial days. In fact, in central Kenya, they used to call him Kimenderi because he used to crush people. He was very violent, actually, during the Mau Mau. Yeah, he was
Kimendero or Kime.
Yeah, he was Komendera. You know, Komendo. You know, he was
crusher.
Yeah, he was crushing people in the 1950s. And therefore, when independence,
because those are the home guards.
He was a home guard. Yeah, that's why he was
the chiefs and whatnot.
Absolutely.
And people,
no, he was a home guard to the extent that he was in the district. He was a DO. At the time.
Yeah, and you had those, you know, in Kitui, and you are very right. They are the ones who get these jobs when they start preparing for people who become PCs and, you know. Mm. All those guys who became PCs were actually DOs or assistant DOs. They just moved in.
So it seems like definitely constitutions tend to be consensus documents, or at least in the case of Kenya, we see that there are certain concessions that were made in the UK.
Yes.
And then we got, you know, this independence constitution, which starts being worked on in terms of amendments almost immediately.
Immediately.
Yeah. What are those things that come to your mind as you think about those amendments that the Jomo Kenyatta regime embarked on as it was consolidating its power to a sense of complete authoritarianism by the time he dies?
You have to track back to the Lancaster House conferences. Mm-hmm. And the participants were three groups. Mm-hmm. There was the KANU group, basically the nationalists.
Kenya African National Union,
And then the Kenya African Democratic
Union, KADU,
which was seen as pro, you know, British, because they also worked very closely with the settlers. Settlers had their own group. I think it was called the New Kenya Group.
The Blundell.
Yeah, Blundell and Kinaslade will be in it, Havelock. The liberal white settlers were actually the ones who are progressive, because they decided that, well, you know, the British were leaving anyway, so they had better participate, and they were all in Lancaster. And as you know, that constitution, the independence constitution, was conflictional. You know, Kenyatta, I think, didn't agree with it.
Especially on the matter of regionalism.
Yes.
The idea of Majimbo.
Yes.
That's what was.
They were against it. So there was, although it was a negotiated constitution through our leaders, but the British knew what they were doing. They threw in it a Bill of Rights. Then they came with the Majimbo, because they thought the nationalism might might be too radical, you know, for their own good. And they basically saw the roots of division. And then KADU, you know, joins KANU after 1 year.
Quickly. And we still don't know whether they were bought or whether it was given positions or what happened.
Yeah, Kenyatta was obviously, you know, bent on, you know, national unity.
Yeah.
And I think the person who discussed that issue very well in some paper is Ngugi, who was basically saying, within KANU, you had the radicals and the conservatives. You know, the conservatives in KANU realized that they had a lot in common with the guys in KADU. Okay? And actually, when KADU joined KANU, and they were given positions, Ngala and Muliro and others, and of course, we should not forget the African People's Party of Ngei, because also joined.
Yes.
Ngugi argues that the reactionaries in KANU were reinforced.
They became stronger.
Yeah, they became stronger. And it didn't take long before the radicals were shown the door.
So they start being edged out, Jaramogi Oginga Odinga, Bilden Kagia, and others.
Yeah, Pindo they kill.
Yeah. And Kali.
Yeah, Kali and some of the union leaders.
Dennis.
The ones who move with Kenya People's Union. And there's that split. That, I think, KPU... it's the only party that I can say was an oppositional party in this country.
This is 1960s. This is now mid, almost like 3 years after independence.
Yeah, because 66 is when they have the little election.
The little election, which now edges out Jaramogi.
Yes.
And enters Moi.
And Kagia also.
And Bilden Kagia, they are voted out.
Murumbi leaves.
Yes.
So
yes.
Moi comes in 67. Still, KPU becomes very, very, very popular with the students.
Yeah.
I remember when we were in Strathmore, we were all members of the KPU.
Yes, yes.
Students will always be on the left. And so they became powerful, and there are two events that show that very clearly. First was the local government elections that took place before KPU was banned in 69, where the KPU's candidates... their papers were rejected. They didn't fill them properly. And the PCs, there's a beautiful photograph of Bill Martin, the PC of Nairobi, throwing the papers to, telling these guys who wanted to vie for local government positions, councillors and so forth in Nairobi. So you can't even fill in the form properly. They were disqualified en masse. Although I think there was somebody who hadn't read the script who allowed the guy to run. So that happens, and then because of the unions and the message that you get from the Wananchi Declaration, that's the KPU manifesto.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, during the Cold War. Okay? So KPU starts being seen as communist, socialist, and whatnot. Yeah. And the banning in 69, which was obviously orchestrated. Kenyatta goes to
69 in Kisumu,
the massacre, and then the banning of the KPU and detaining almost the entire leadership, you know, of KPU, and having what you might call the de facto one-party state, which I think the West was now comfortable with. They didn't want...
Then, of course, at that period, from 1969, with now the detention of the KPU leadership, you also get, again, a certain radical team, J.M. Kariuki and others in parliament, Machofi and others, pushing certain ideas.
You know, it's an interesting issue, that particular one, because J.M., obviously was Kenyatta's private secretary and then became an MP and became fairly radical.
Yes.
But I think he was murdered because of the succession issues, just like Mboya and so forth. But KANU always had an opposition, you know, within it.
Within it.
Yeah. And the best one was what you mentioned, the Seven Bearded Sisters.
Yeah.
And a sister, because there was a
sister. There was a sister, Chelagat Mutai.
Chelagat was a sister. But then Mwachofi,
Koigi,
Orengo. Anyona, Orengo.
There was Chebule.
Osuma. Chebula, yeah, Chebule Osuma.
Those were the bearded ones. Correct. Because Abuye Abuye and Lawrence Ifuna were not bearded.
Correct.
But they did a lot of work. And they did a lot of work with the University Staff Union, because they used to come there and address students and so forth.
And they were all pushing for a constitutional environment in which there would be more freedoms, you know. And of course, they were also addressing fundamental issues.
Particularly the political and civil rights.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They were very strong on that. And of course, they were dismantled very, very quickly. And that's when you now see the underground movements, because there was no space above ground anymore.
So the underground movements, all this work happening in the 1980s.
Yes.
Then 1991, with the repeal of Section 2A, which now allows the re-entry of multi-party political participation, 1991. Then we have the 1992 elections.
Right.
Why do you think Moi carved in to allow for this? Because
it's changed radically with the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the one-party dictatorships had outlived their uses as far as the neocolonialism was concerned, right? Mm-hmm. And because there was this agitation also coming from people who should have been in, because people like Odinga, Masinde Muliro, and others, they were ethnic barons, and you couldn't keep them out, you know, for long. But I think the pivotal thing was 89, the Berlin Wall collapses, the Soviet Union collapses. The one-party dictatorship ceases to be seen as a bastion against, you know, communism, and the support of multipartism actually comes from internally, but also, you know, externally. Moi had no was pushed to it.
Yeah, and then of course, so we have the repeal of Section 2A. Then we have the IPPG in 1997.
Yeah,
some people have argued that the IPPG agreement kind of slowed the pace of reform, because before 1997 there was a lot of pressure from civil society, and then now you have the political elite participating in IPPG and kind of almost determining the direction of change.
Yeah, the point you mentioned politically is so critical. How those who are in power use concessions to slow down, you know, movements that might bring about revolution or very radical, you know, radical changes. And you see that globally with what is called welfare capitalism after 1945. Where the leadership in Europe and even America decide very clearly and consciously that they have to intervene in the market to protect the workers and others from high, you know, food prices, rents. And in the UK, there is a healthcare, which is universal. And they even give benefits to those who didn't work. That's what Shivji says. It was welfare, but for us, it dominated. It was war because we are the ones who paid for it. It was warfare for it. So there is that strategy which works. And Moi uses it very well, in my view. He had no way but to, you know, to repeal 2A. Because you read the stuff of Hempston, and Bernard, the German, you know, guy, they were pushing, you know, for multipartism because that was the way to go.
The American ambassador, Hempston.
But Musenberg was the German one, you know, who in some meeting walked out of Urupak when Moi was talking. But the election now, the reforms that Moi became pretty clever with, you know, the IPPG, for example. Because the way NCC was dismantled overnight, where Moi advised by Jilu Fanana, yes, and other people, and Anyona, of,
yes,
all people,
yes,
basically using money, but also telling Akina Kibaki and others, what is it that you want? Why are you with this civil society people, mm-hmm, who are not elected by anybody?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he quickly, when you look at the minimum reforms, they were very specific, opening spaces for political parties, not civil society,
yeah,
that they will have an IBC that they can trust. And Moi akawambia, leteni watu wenu. Bring your own people. Anyona brought his brother
to IBC.
And Moi, of course, he bought all those members,
yeah,
in, you know, in 92. There is no doubt about that.
Because he was interested in he was interested in expats driving, so-called expats again,
yeah,
driving the constitution reforms,
yeah,
the reform agenda.
Yeah.
That's why he talks about why should we even have an Awanjiko?
Yes, that's where Awanjiko comes from, because Moi wanted to bring in experts, foreign experts,
mm,
to write the constitution, which is very easy. You can always get a draft.
Yeah.
It's not rocket science. He didn't want the comprehensive one where people will have to participate. And that's why, in frustration, he says, what does Wanjiku know, you know, about the constitution? And that's how Gado as a cartoonist shows that Wanjiku is a philosopher, is a theologian, is everything. So the ordinary person can actually participate, giving us a lot of support in terms of participation of the people.
So Moi, mm-hmm, in the late 90s,
yeah,
tries to do exactly,
mm-hmm,
what the colonial,
yeah,
regimes were doing,
yeah,
in the late 50s,
yeah,
in terms of really driving the process of continuity.
Yeah, and even in 92, people forget that there was a handshake. Moi completely destroyed the opposition through Kibaki. I'm quite certain that
Kibaki formed the Democratic Party.
Yes, mm, yes. If the opposition of Odinga and Matiba and Kibaki came together, okay, Moi would have been history in 92.
No, actually, I recall the Kamukunji rally at that time, and
yeah,
I recall really,
mm,
I have never seen,
mm,
anything as powerful as what I saw in 1991,
yes,
1992,
yes,
before,
mm-hmm,
the Democratic Party becomes formed.
That's right. And when Matiba comes
from London,
yeah, did you see how the thousands and thousands of people,
yes,
lined the route from airport?
Yes.
And Moi, very cleverly, in my view,
introduces
Panja, that thing, that was, you might say, the second handshake, because the first one was Kadu.
Yeah.
And you were right. He was very good at understanding the politics, and he realized, well, the opposition, you can divide them,
mm-hmm,
you know, on the basis of this. And he won by what, 38% then?
Yeah, 38%, because the opposition was completely split.
Yeah, and then 97. You are right. Concessions. Give them concession. Call them. Don't talk to these radicals. Talk to us. What is it you want? Okay. You want the minimal reform. So the certain statutes are amended almost immediately so that they can address rallies and they can move. Because they didn't have political and civil rights at all.
This is absolutely interesting, and I will pause for a moment.
Yeah.
When we pick up our conversation, we,
yeah,
pick it from 2002.
Yes.
And then what happens,
yes,
after,
sure,
the NAC government. This concludes our second episode in our three-part series of this podcast about constitution making in Kenya with Chief Justice Professor Willy Mutunga, President of the Supreme Court of Kenya. Thank you for listening to the Africa Speaking Podcast. Join us in our next episode, brought to you by Triazer Communications. My name is Kimani Njogu. For any comments and views, you can reach us through our website, www.africaspeaking.org. You can also reach us on Facebook, Triazer Communications, or on our Twitter handle @TawezaComs. You can also write to us on email info@africaspeaking.org.